Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading True West Magazine for October 2022. So-called Cattle Kate Rises from Rubbish by Jana Bombersbatch. Evidence points toward Ella Watson's innocence. Cattle Kate was the only woman ever hanged in Wyoming for cattle rustling, and history long portrayed the act as good riddance to bad rubbish. Powder River War historian Helen Huntington Smith wrote that Ella Watson's lynching was the most revolting crime in the entire annals of the West. Uncovered evidence strongly supports Ella's ownership of the cattle she was accused of stealing, while stories about her being a loose and wild woman were clearly concocted by her killers. On top of that, authorities never brought the accused killers to trial because the witnesses mysteriously died or disappeared before they could tell the court what they had seen. And on a sunny Saturday in 1889, it's believed that powerful Wyoming ranchers murdered Watson because she had gotten in their way. Ella's dream. Ella was born in Canada on July 2, 1861, the oldest of 10 children. Her family moved to Kansas, where she married at 18 to a man who abused her. After her divorce, she went to Denver, then Cheyenne, and finally to Rawlins, where she worked as a cook and domestic for 2 years at the Rawlins house. Some erroneously thought this was a brothel and labeled her a prostitute, confusing Ella with a known prostitute of the time who had the same name. It was at Rawlins' house in February 1866 that Ella met James Averell, a widower with a homestead claim in the Sweetwater River Valley, where he had established a road ranch and general store. The couple dreamed of marriage, but Ella also dreamed of owning her own homestead on adjoining land. One precluded the other, since the law only allowed one claim per family. On May 11th, the couple traveled 100 miles to Lander to obtain a marriage license, forever keeping their union secret to protect their plan to become large landowners. In August, Ella filed a squatter's claim on 160 acres along Horse Creek, then built a two-room log cabin and dug irrigation ditches. The next month, Jim filed a claim for his irrigation ditch from the creek. None of this sat well with the neighbors. Cattle baron Albert Bothwell irrigated a hay meadow from Horse Creek and ran cattle on nearby land, land he didn't own but was using anyway. He apparently hadn't anticipated anyone laying claim to the land, especially a woman, and wanted no restrictions on the precious water from the creek. He repeatedly offered to buy Ella's claim, but the feisty woman wouldn't sell. Ella was building a nest egg to buy cattle by selling dinners at Jim's Roadhouse for 50 cents each and working in the general store. Her secret husband, meanwhile, was making extra income from his new job at the Sweetwater Postmaster, a position of respect that added weight to his words. Jim began writing letters to the editor of the Casper newspaper, in which he called his neighbors land sharks and openly charged them with filing illegal land claims under the guise that they were improving the property when they were merely moving a portable cabin from one claim to another. Brand marks trouble. Jim and Ella felt their neighbors' wrath when they tried to get brands approved for their emerging herds. Without an approved brand from the commission controlled by the cattlemen, cattle were fair game for poachers. Ella's request was denied, while Jim received his fifth rejection since his first request in 1885. Even without a brand, Ella started her herd. In the fall of 1888, she bought 28 head from a man driving the cattle from Nebraska to the Salt Lake area. Ella did not record a bill of sale. She claimed it was in a safe deposit box in a bank, but it was never found. Then, on March 23, 1889, with her improvements and herd in place, she filed her official homestead claim. She and Jim now owned more than 320 acres. Soon after, she did an end run around the brand commission, buying an existing brand from a nearby rancher. By July, she had 41 head of cattle wearing her LU brand. On the morning of July 20th, stock detective George Henderson rode through Ella's pasture. He took the news of Ella's cattle brand to other members of the stock association, including Bothwell, who had been trying unsuccessfully for years to force Ella and Jim off land he considered his pasture. Bothwell had to know Ella had owned most of those cows for nearly a year, but he called his fellow cattlemen together. One verified the brands were new, and six men took the matter into their own hands. Joining Bothwell were Ernest McLean, Robert Galbraith, John Durbin, Robert Connor, and Tom's son. At Ella's ranch, Durbin reportedly was so angry that he started tearing down her fences and driving the cattle out, 14-year-old John DeCorey said. About that time, Ella returned home from a nearby Shoshone encampment where she had bought a pair of intricately beaded deerskin moccasins, reports Lori Van Pelt in the 2003 Wild Woman of the Old West. Ella was directed to get into Sun's wagon. DeCorey said she wanted to go into the house and change, but they would not let her. Bothwell told her he would rope her and drag her if she did not get in. From there, the group went to Jim's place, forcing Jim into the wagon. Having been alerted by the boy, cowboy Frank Buchanan rode after the lynch party. Buchanan saw Bothwell tie a rope around Jim's neck, while McLean tried to rope a kicking and screaming Ella, wrote Dorothy Gray in Women of the West. Buchanan said he shot at the men, emptying his revolver twice, but faced return gunfire from Winchester's. He frantically rode to the ranch to tell what was happening and then fetched the sheriff. The bodies were left to hang in the July heat for 2.5 days. A reporter who described the scene said it was clear both man and woman had fought for their lives until the last. No sooner was Ella Watson dead, wrote Gray, that the stockman started a press campaign in which she was transformed into Cattle Kate, characterized as having not only rustled more cattle than any man in the West, but as having been a prostitute, husband poisoner, and holdup artist. Some of Ella's friends tried to set the record straight. DeCorey declared in a letter to the Casper Weekly Mail that the cattle were legally hers. She bought them and paid her own money for them, and had them in her possession ever since I had been with her, Van Pelt reports. Another man, John Fales, came forward to say he had driven the purchased cattle to Jim's ranch. Unsettling end. Yes, the ranchers were indicted, but they never went to trial. Although several witnesses had identified them, all either disappeared or died mysteriously. Jim's nephew died, possibly of poisoning, on the very day he was scheduled to testify. The cowboy was said to have wandered all over the country, hiding and fearing for his life from the Wyoming ranchers. The young boy left town and was never heard from again. Gray notes that this lynching was one of the opening skirmishes in Wyoming's notorious Johnson County War, pitting the stockholders against the rest of the citizens. But some were clearly on the ranchers' side. Van Pelt notes that the Daily Sun editorialized, "No one who knows the gentleman implicated would believe that they would commit an act of this nature without ample justification and except under the pressure of direct necessity." The court-appointed administrator for the estates of Ella and Jim filed against Albert Bothwell and John Durbin for the return of 41 head of cattle, the same cattle the men had claimed were stolen and used as the excuse for the lynching. The suit was never acted upon, Van Pelt reports. Ella's land was sold at auction by her father, but eventually ended up in Bothwell's hands. So did Jim's land. Bothwell is said to have moved his house onto Ella's claim. As Van Pelt notes, the killers went on to live long and successful lives. The same year as the lynching, both Bothwell and Son were elected to the executive committee of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association, and Robert Galbraith was elected to the Wyoming Territorial Legislature. On the 100th anniversary of Ella's death in 1989, her family held a reunion in Casper and openly discussed the event with historians. Watson's relatives believe Ella was murdered by rough neighbors, cattlemen so enraged by the fact that she and James Averill homesteaded in the middle of prime pasture near a creek with a good supply of water that the stock owners resorted to their own deadly solution, Van Pelt notes. But that view angers some of the ancestors of the men who conducted the lynching, she adds. From her research, Van Pelt says Ella Watson cannot conclusively be proven innocent or guilty of the crimes she was accused of in the summer of 1889. But others say the evidence stacks up nicely in her corner, revealing that a 28-year-old woman who was murdered has been unjustly maligned all these years. After many years of research on the life of Ella Watson, Jana Bommersbach published Cattle Kate, a novel, Poison Pen Press, in 2014. She is currently writing Real Women of the West with Bob Bozbell. True West, October 2022 edition. Rawlins, Wyoming, by Peter Corbett. The Old West is alive in the county seat and its neighboring towns of Carbon County. Butch Cassidy and his Wild Bunch were well known around Carbon County in south central Wyoming in the 1890s. After a heist, the outlaw gang would flee to Little Snake River country to elude capture, the Idaho Statesman reported in 1909. They would clatter into the little town of Bags, whooping and yelling and shooting out all the panes of window glass they had missed on previous visits, the article said. Leslie Jefferson, Carbon County Visitors Council CEO, said the gang stayed in the Bags Roadhouse of Pearl Matthew Gaddis. The Matthews Gaddis house was the bar of choice, she said. They would wake up the town and have a party for a few days. Reports say a local fiddler, Tom Vernon, would jam with Cassidy on harmonica and turn the place into a rowdy dance hall. The Bags Roadhouse is one of many historic sites, museums, guest ranches, vintage hotels, and other attractions in Carbon County's 10 small towns: Bags, Dixon, Elk Mountain, Encampment, Hannah, Medicine Bow, Riverside, Saratoga, Savory, and Rawlins, the county seat. Rawlins is named for General John Rawlins, a member of the 1867 surveying party that established a Union Pacific Railroad route across Wyoming. I think the best way to experience Carbon County is to find lodging you'd like to be at for a few days, Jefferson said. Then you can take multiple day trips and scenic drives. Rawlins is home to the Stark Fortress of the Wyoming Frontier Prison, which incarcerated 13,500 inmates from 1901 to 1981. Tours are offered daily from Memorial Day to Labor Day. The 1987 B-movie, Prison, starring Viggo Mortensen, was filmed in the penitentiary. If historic prisons aren't your thing, the soothing waters of Carbon County's mineral baths appeal to most weary travelers. Head southeast to Saratoga for a soak in its hot springs. Anyone can enjoy the free Hobo Hot Pool, which has a bathhouse with showers and is open 24 hours a day all year long. Saratoga Hot Springs Resort has been hosting guests for more than a century. Its mineral baths are covered by teepees to provide privacy. The resort also features a 9-hole golf course, brew pub, and rental access to mountain bikes, all-terrain vehicles, and snowmobiles. Saratoga's other historic inn is the Hotel Wolf, which opened in 1893. Its current owners, Doug and Kathleen Campbell, have operated the 3-story brick hotel for 45 years. It includes a saloon and dining room. Medicine Bow, northeast of Saratoga, takes a bow from its 1911 Virginian Hotel, named for Western writer Owen Wister, whose 1902 novel, The Virginian, is considered one of the first and best Westerns ever written. Carbon County is also home to luxury guest ranches. Brush Creek Ranch near Saratoga was branded in 2020 as the best U.S. resort by readers of Travel and Leisure magazine. It includes a spa, distillery, bakery, creamery, and the 20,000-square-foot greenhouse where vegetables for its dining room are grown. Guest activities include fly fishing, target shooting, hiking, rock climbing, and riding horses. Three Forks Ranch, near the Colorado border at Savory, Wyoming, is focused on health and wellness. In addition to outdoor activities, hiking, trout fishing, and skiing, guests can enjoy a wide array of treatments at the 6,000-square-foot spa. Another Carbon County lodging gem is the Elk Mountain Hotel. The cozy three-story hotel in Elk Mountain has hosted travelers since 1905. Prior to that, it was the stage stop on the Overland Trail at a crossing of the Medicine Bow River. The hotel was linked with the Garden Spot Pavilion, a dance hall that, after World War II, featured dozens of touring acts, including Bob Wills, Hank Thompson, and Tex Williams, whose big hit song was "Smoke, Smoke, Smoke That Cigarette." True West, October 2022 edition. "Quién Es Pete?" by Bob Bowes Bell. Classic gunfights, features, and gunfights. July 14, 1881. Billy the Kid versus Pat Garrett. Bad Moon Rising. Rising at dawn, Garrett, Poe, and McKinney ride up into the hills and scan the landscape with field glasses. After an hour or two, Garrett sends Poe into Sumner to take observations and arranges to meet him 4 miles north of Fort Sumner. Poe noses around the plaza and gleans no news of the kid's whereabouts, although he later claims there was a very tense situation in Fort Sumner that day, as the kid was at that very time hiding in one of the natives' houses there. He then rides on to Sunnyside, 7 miles above Sumner, to interview Postmaster Milner Rudolph. It was Rudolph's son, Charles, who rode in the posse at Stinking Spring. Rudolph admits he has heard rumors of the kid's presence, but doesn't believe them. When Poe questions him further, Rudolph becomes nervous and evasive. Poe leaves Sunnyside after dark and meets up with Garrett and McKinney at the proposed meeting place. The three decide to slip into Fort Sumner in the darkness and see what they can find. At about 9 p.m., Sheriff Pat Garrett and two deputies, John Poe and Tom Kip McKinney, ensconce themselves within a peach orchard on the northern boundary of Fort Sumner. A full moon looms above. As the lawmen creep toward the buildings, they hear voices. Stopping, they realize someone else is in the orchard. Soon, a man arose from the ground, Garrett later remembers, in full view, but too far away to recognize. He wore a broad-brimmed hat, a dark vest and pants, and was in his shirt sleeves. The dark figure says something indiscernible to the officers, jumps the fence, and walks into the compound. Garrett later learns this was Billy the Kid. The inference is that Billy had just finished making love in the green grass. By now, it is nearly midnight. Garrett and his deputies back out of the orchard and approach Pete Maxwell's house. The three men slip silently onto Maxwell's south porch. Garrett posts his two deputies at the front gate and goes inside. Poe sits on the edge of the steps in the open gate, and McKinney squats just outside. A full moon lights up the cottonwood trees along the Pecos River as a dark figure slips into the side yard of a long, low adobe. Once inside, he goes straight to her bedroom at the southeast corner. Opening the door just a crack, he sees the love of his life. He has risked everything for her, and she is as beautiful as he has remembered. As he quietly slips inside and starts to undress, he suddenly senses something moving out the window on the parade ground. He freezes and instinctively ducks down to the floor and inches forward toward the front window. As he carefully peers out, he spies two strangers crouched and conversing at the front gate. Staying low, he moves like a cat across the room and out into the darkened hallway. He quietly slips into the corner bedroom across the hall. "Quién es? Quién es Pete? Who is it? Who is it, Pete?" There is no answer, but he senses someone besides Pete is also in the room. One more time, he whispers, "Quién es?" There is a loud explosion, and it's the last thing he remembers before the darkness takes him. Stocking Feet Don't Lie. Essentially, Sheriff Pat Garrett caught Billy the Kid with his pants down in a darkened bedroom. After the shooting, all the principals agreed on one thing. An explanation needed to be fashioned that would get Billy out of the house, but it needed to include him being in his stocking feet. Why they didn't just lie about this part as well is kind of mystifying, but it was, after all, a Victorian time, and the proper thing to do was to protect Pete's little sister, Paulita was 15, from scandal. And so all of the ridiculous and strained details about walking across the parade ground in his stocking feet to get meat was made up to protect the Maxwell name. Aftermath, odds and ends. Jesus Silva and several local women asked permission to move Billy's body to the old carpenter shop on the eastern side of the fort, and they laid him on a workbench. The kid's fatal wound was plugged with a rag, while the Hispano women washed and cleaned the kid's body for the wake. Candles were soon lit and placed around his corpse. News spread about the killing, and soon enough, almost everyone in the immediate vicinity showed up. On the morning of July 15th, a coffin constructed by Jesus Silva with help from Vicente Otero and a few others. Pete Maxwell chipped in $25 to buy Billy some new clothes. A beige suit, shirt, undergarments, and a pair of stockings were purchased, and the outlaw was dressed out for burial. Once in the casket, the kid was moved to Beaver Smith's saloon, where it remained on display until the grave was dug, and he was transported to his final resting place in the Fort Sumner Cemetery. Recommended, The Illustrated Life and Times of Billy the Kid, Volume 3, and Final Word by Bob Bozbell, and Billy the Kid, El Bandido Simpatico by James B. Mills. True West, October 2022 edition. A Fitting Funeral for Billy the Kid by James B. Mills. What really happened to El Chivato? Billy arrived at the home of Celsa and Saval Gutierrez, where he sometimes had a siesta, instead of the Maxwell house. He was carrying a hock of beef leg and headed into the kitchen before returning to the room where Celsa and her husband were situated. "Celsa, I brought some meat for you to make my supper," the kid said. Although Billy presumed Senora Gutierrez could manage something with it, upon seeing the hock of a leg in the kitchen, the Guerrero beauty knew it was pointless to even try. "Billy, this meat that you brought is no more than a bone," Celsa called out. "It doesn't have any meat." "Give me a knife to go get some good meat," Billy answered from the other room in Spanish, "and tell Don Pedro that I took the meat so that he doesn't think that another stole the meat." Celsa's 7-year-old illegitimate son, Candido, watched as Billy took the butcher knife that his mother loaned him. The kid headed outside and made his way down inside the white picket fence parallel with the western end of the parade ground. A full moon shone down upon him. He was in his stocking feet, dark pants, and a white dress shirt with a silk handkerchief around his neck. He briskly walked past the dance hall and flower garden to his left and was fastening his trousers as he approached the Maxwell house. It was almost 12:30 in the morning on Friday, July 15th, 1881. Billy was strolling toward the front of the Maxwell house when he suddenly spotted a shadowy figure sitting on the edge of the porch in front of the small gateway leading out toward the old parade ground. He would have spotted this hombre sitting in the darkness sooner had his view not been obstructed by the post of the gate. He quickly pulled his double-action Colt revolver and threw down on the stranger while springing onto the Maxwell porch. "¿Quién es? Who is it?" Billy asked. Receiving no answer, he began backing away toward Pete Maxwell's bedroom door. "¿Quién es?" the kid asked again. "¿Quién es?" The unfamiliar fellow sitting on the edge of the porch stood up and stepped toward him, telling him in Spanish not to be alarmed and that he shouldn't get hurt. John W. Poe had no idea it was Billy the Kid he was giving these assurances to, thinking it was a guest of Maxwell's. Billy didn't recognize Poe either, having never laid eyes on him. With the shadowy figure of Kip McKinney, whom Billy had also never seen, watching on from outside the fence, John W. Poe continued to advance toward the kid to reassure him. Billy was unconvinced by the stranger's assurances and backed into the doorway of Pete Maxwell's bedroom. "Key and S," he asked once again, before disappearing from Poe's sight. Appearing as a silhouette in the moonlit doorway of Pedro Maxwell's bedroom, Billy slowly stepped through the darkness across the carpet toward Pete Maxwell's bed with his revolver in his right hand and the butcher knife in his left. He then leaned forward and reached out toward the presumably asleep Pedro. "Pedro, ¿quiénes son estos hombres afuera?" "Pete, who are those men outside?" the kid asked. As Billy reached toward the bed, unbeknownst to him, his hand had almost brushed the knee of Pat Garrett, who was sitting on the side of the bed next to Maxwell. Finally sensing the presence of someone sitting at the head of the bed, Billy raised his revolver and began stepping swiftly back across the room toward the door. "¿Quién es?" the kid asked. "El es. It's him," Pete Maxwell whispered as softly as possible to Garrett. "Who is it?" Billy asked once more while peering through the darkness. While remaining seated at the head of Maxwell's bed, Pete Garrett raised his single-action revolver, cocked the hammer, and fired at the silhouette figure standing in the room. With a split-second flash of light filling the bedroom, the shot hit Billy in the left side of his chest, just above the heart. As the kid fell forward onto the carpet with a horrid burning sensation coursing through his chest, Pat Garrett leaped off the side of the bed and fired another shot, this one ricocheting off a wall and slamming into the headboard of Maxwell's bed. Pat Garrett had barely finished squeezing the trigger for the second time before he was bolting from the darkened bedroom, running through the doorway and brushing past John W. Poe outside. Almost as quickly, Pete Maxwell came running frantically behind him, entangled in bedclothes and almost slamming into Poe, who instinctively raised his gun on him. "Don't shoot!" Maxwell cried. "Don't shoot!" With his heart racing, Pat Garrett reached over and swatted Poe's gun downwards. "Don't shoot Maxwell," the sheriff said. The slight sound of a groan and gasping had been heard coming from inside the bedroom until silence fell. "That was the kid that came in there onto me," Garrett said to Poe, "and I think I've got him." "Pat, the kid would not have come to this place," Poe replied. "You have shot the wrong man." "I am sure it was him," Garrett asserted. "I know his voice too well to be mistaken." The two shots Pat Garrett had fired were heard throughout Fort Sumner, and residents soon began arriving on the scene. Jesus Silva, Francisco Lovato, and Paco Anaya all quickly made their way toward the Maxwell home, with others following suit. When Silva, Lovato, and Anaya arrived, they saw Pat Garrett standing alongside his two deputies in front of the Maxwell house. Standing with them were Pete Maxwell, Doña Luz Maxwell, and Dulavina Maxwell. Manuel Pedro Abreu and Pablo and Rebecca Biobian had also made their way there after hearing the shots. Paulita Maxwell was there too, after having been awakened in her bedroom by the gunshots. Many of Fort Sumner's other residents also began to emerge and wanted to know what had happened. Word was already spreading that Belito had gone into Don Pedro's bedroom and had been killed. Pat Garrett was reluctant to venture back inside Pete Maxwell's bedroom and confirm it was indeed Billy the Kid whom he had shot. Instead, Pat and his deputies watched as Deluvina Maxwell retrieved a lamp. "Voya entrar. I'm going in," she announced. Jesus Silva accompanied Deluvina down the porch to Pete Maxwell's bedroom and cautiously tapped on the door. "I don't want to hurt you, Billy," Silva called out. "It's Jesus, and I'm coming in." When there was no answer, Jesus and Deluvina slowly entered the eerily silent bedroom. As they peered through the darkness with use of the lamp, they found the slight frame of a young man with a head of brown hair lying face down on the carpet. They turned the lifeless body over, and a familiar boyish face appeared within the dim glow of the light. Deluvina immediately started to cry. Henry McCarty, alias William H. Boney, was dead. He was around 20 or 21 years old. Delluvina soon emerged from Pete Maxwell's bedroom with tears streaming down her face. Mi chiquito está muerto. My little boy is dead, she cried. The Navajo woman sobbing soon turned to rage as she proceeded to unleash a verbal tirade on Pat Garrett, calling him every vile name she could lace her tongue to. You pisspot, Delluvina cursed him while thumping his chest. You son of a bitch. Pete Maxwell procured a tallow candle from Doña Luz's bedroom at the other end of the house. He placed it on the windowsill before accompanying Pat Garrett and Kit McKinney into the room. Making their own examination of the scene, Poe recalled, we saw a man lying stretched upon his back, dead, in the middle of the room, with a six-shooter lying at his right hand and a butcher knife at his left. Upon examining the body, we found it to be that of Billy the Kid. We searched long and faithfully, found both my bullet marks and none other, recalled Pat Garrett. We examined his pistol, a self-cocker, caliber 41. It had five cartridges and one shell in the chambers, the hammer resting on the shell. This shell looked as though as it had been shot some time before. There wasn't even one Mexican cent in the outlaw's pockets when the officers searched him, recalled Jesus Silva. Pat Garrett took his gun. At one point, John W. Poe saw Paulita Maxwell standing and observing Billy's body for a considerable length of time. Her face was inexpressive, presumably from shock. The tears eventually came, and she had to be consoled by other young women in the vicinity. If Billy had spoken truthfully when telling Martin Chavez of his willingness to die for Paulita several months earlier, then he had fulfilled his vow. Cursed and despised. With Delluvina Maxwell and Jesus Silva confirming Billy's death, their anger was soon shared by many Hispanos who gathered at the scene. While some of the señoritas cried and consoled each other, men shook their fists in anger and cursed the gringo lawman. Billy had been very popular at Fort Sumner and had a great many friends, all of whom were indignant toward Pat Garrett, recalled Francisco Lovato. If a leader had been present, Garrett and his two officers would have received the same fate they dealt Billy. With tensions rising and some of the Hispanos hurling insults at them, also being armed, Pat Garrett, John W. Poe, and Kit McKinney retreated into the Maxwell home. We spent the remainder of the night on the Maxwell premises, keeping constantly on our guard as we expected attack by the friends of the dead man, explained Poe. Pat Garrett and his two companions were badly frightened and did not dare to sleep that night, remembered Jesus Silva. They remained awake, arms in readiness for any emergency. Despite the outrage expressed by so many, no attempt at reprisal was made. Someone in Fort Sumner must have given Billy away, Silva later correctly surmised. Jesus Silva and several señoritos asked permission to move Billy's body. At Pete Maxwell's suggestion, William Bonney's slender corpse was carried out of his bedroom to the old carpenter shop on the eastern side of the fort and laid out on a workbench. After his fatal gunshot wound was sealed with a rag, Hispano women gently washed and cleaned the kid's body in preparation for his impending wake. Candles were soon lit and placed around his corpse as part of properly conducting a wake for the dead, John W. Poe recalled. While Delluvina Maxwell and Hispano women cried and prayed over Billy's body, Vicente Otero stood observing the wake the remainder of the night along with Juan Medina, Juan Nepomuceno Pacheco, and many more of the kid's amigos. Word of Billy's death spread quickly throughout the old fort, with frantic messengers running to each adobe residence to share the news with those who hadn't heard it. With many locals arriving in the vicinity, the question, "Who shot him?" was asked by many, and soon answered for all. Many señoritas and señoras wailed in grief, crying, "Pobre Billy," poor Billy. It was a sentiment later shared by Jesus Silva. Poor old Billy, Silva said years later. Billy was a good boy. He just had to do that way. A local hero's Hispano funeral. On the morning of July 15, 1881, a coffin was constructed by Jesus Silva with help from Vicente Otero and others. Pat Garrett had advised them to use ceiling planks stripped from an abandoned adobe house for the coffin's construction. Garrett also gave Pete Maxwell $25 to buy some new clothes in which Billy's corpse could be dressed for burial. Maxwell accompanied Manuel Abreu to the store, where he purchased a beige suit, shirt, undergarments, and a pair of stockings. Paco Anaya, his brother-in-law, Egino Garcia, and several others then dressed Billy's corpse in the new clothes. Word of Billy the Kid's death had spread rapidly through the surrounding countryside, and Fort Sumner was soon inundated with the arrivals of Milner Rudolph, Mike Cosgrove, and others. At Pat Garrett's insistence, a coroner's report was held. Justice of the Peace Alejandro Segura had been sent for to conduct the report and appoint a coroner's jury. The jury included Milner Rudolph, who acted as foreman, along with Saval Gutierrez, 37-year-old sheepherder Lorenzo Jaramillo, Pedro Antonio Lucero, Antonio Saavedra, and Jose Silva. Except for the kid's final words, the report was written entirely in Spanish, with the illiterate Gutierrez, Jaramillo, and Silva signing with an X. The coroner's report ended with the declaration, "We, the jury, unanimously find that William Bonney has been killed by a bullet in the left breast in the region of the heart, the same having been fired from a pistol in the hand of Pat F. Garrett, and our verdict is that the act of said Garrett was justifiable homicide, and we are unanimous in the opinion that the gratitude of all the community is due to the said Garrett for his deed, and is worthy of being rewarded." The final sentence was certainly written at the behest of Pat Garrett to ensure he would be able to claim the $500 reward money from acting governor William Rich. While some citizens throughout the territory would later shake Garrett's hand and congratulate him for ridding the Southwest of a notorious outlaw, the majority of Hispano citizens of Fort Sumner were hardly grateful to him, nor would they have felt he was worthy of being rewarded for killing their Belito in the middle of the night. After Billy's body was placed in his coffin, it was moved to Beaver Smith's saloon, where it remained on display until time for burial. Jesus Silva and Vicente Otero dug a grave down in the old cemetery. In the afternoon, William H. Bonney's coffin was sealed and loaded into the back of Vicente Otero's creaky old wagon. With the throng of at least 170 people following behind, the coffin was slowly led down to the fort's old military cemetery by two lean ponies, with the loud creaking from the turning wheels of Otero's rickety wagon serving as Billy's requiem mass. "Most of the native people who lived in town went to his funeral," recalled Delavina Maxwell. "Practically every man, woman, and child in town followed the body to the little cemetery," remembered Paulita Maxwell. When the large funeral procession reached the old military cemetery, pallbearers Jesus Silva, Paco Anaya, Vicente Otero, and Saval Gutierrez, Antonio Saavedra, and others lowered the coffin into the freshly dug grave to the southwest of the northern entrance. In the opposite direction of the northeast corner lay the unmarked graves of Tom Folliard, Charlie Baudry, and Joe Grant. After the coffin was lowered and the grave filled, a sermon in Spanish was likely said by someone before the large congregation dispersed. Sheriff Pat Garrett dismissed his two deputies, rode out of Fort Sumner with Pete Maxwell after carrying out the job he had been elected to do. He was riding for Las Vegas before heading to Santa Fe, after meeting resistance from acting Governor William Rich over the $500 reward. He met with Thomas B. Catrone and Marcus Brunswick for support in attempting to secure the money. "There was no use chasing him in that country with the start he had," Garrett later said. "I waited until I thought he would reach his sweethearts at the Maxwell Ranch House, and I got him." after a small cross placed at his gravesite, crudely bearing his most famous alias, had been stolen a short time later, the grave of Henry McCarty, a.k.a. William H. Bonney, was marked by a plain board bearing the stenciled words, Billy the Kid. Delavina Maxwell, forever harboring an intense hatred for Pat Garrett and his deputies, left flowers on the grave of her Chiquito in the summer for many years. One can only imagine her reaction had she known the role Pedro Maxwell had played in bringing about her little boy's death. In Anton Chico, Padre Antonio Redon could be heard to remark, Billy did not have a bad heart. Most of his crimes were those of vengeance. 2 weeks after William Bonney's death, the Grant County Herald offered its own epitaph. He was a low-down, vulgar cutthroat with probably not one redeeming quality. No low-down, vulgar cutthroat was ever so well-liked and fondly remembered by so many who knew him. Ancient Grains, True West Magazine, October 2022 edition, by Sherry Monahan. From the arrival of Spanish missionaries to the present day, Arizona's climate has proved to be ideal for growing superior varieties of wheat, barley, spelt, and oaks. Arizona may have a dry and arid climate, but the pioneers grew a variety of crops, including fruits and grains. Grains were an important commodity during the 1800s and early 1900s. Pioneer grain farmers primarily grew white Sonora wheat, one of the varieties of white wheat in North America. It was carried over by the missionaries in the 1700s and became a very popular variety throughout the Southwest until the early 1900s. As railroads expanded in Arizona, newer varieties of wheat like Turkey Red and Early Bart replaced the white Sonora, with some claiming its quality was inferior to others being grown in Kansas and Oklahoma. In the 1870s, grain farmers struggled with keeping their grains from parching in the heat, but managed with irrigation. In 1873, P.R. Brady in Florence reported business dull, mainly on account of poor demand from grain. Farmers all at work, ground dry, there having been no rain for several months past. Mr. B's flouring mill running steadily and making 4,300 pounds superfine flour every 12 hours. Plenty of water in river for irrigating. It was 1874 when Charles Trumbull Hayden realized there was a real opportunity in Tempe, so he built a mill near the modern corner of Mill Avenue and Rio Salado Parkway. His business was successful and flourished for over 120 years. In 1876, Hayden had a merchandise store in Prescott where he sold family, superfine, graham, and cracked wheat flour. In 1878, Phoenix's Salt River Herald reported that the land in Salt River Valley was prime agricultural land. It reported the soil is rich in alluvium, capable of producing, with good tillage, 20 to 50 bushels of wheat, barley, and corn to the acre. Between 1880 to 81, Arizona had 10 flour mills that produced over 5 million pounds of flour. In the 1880s, the grain farmers had to contend with fruit and flour growers who wanted more land to expand their fields. Arizona was fast becoming a flour and fruit producing area. Many farmers felt the grain farmers' time had passed and that they needed to make way for flour and fruit growers. Both existed, and in the 1890s, Arizona grass and grain farmers were successfully producing alfalfa, barley, oats, and wheat. In 1900, those grains were being used in menus across Arizona. The Arizona Republic suggested a Thanksgiving menu that included cream of barley soup, toasted crackers, pies, whole wheat bread, and donuts. Around the turn of the century, newer varieties of wheat and barley were being planted. Hullus barley, spelt, and emmer grains were used for a variety of items, including cereal. The Holbrook Argus had an ad for Salzer's Farm Seeds that read, Salzer's Spelt's Emmer, greatest cereal wonder of the age. We know spelt and emmer as heirloom varieties today, but back in the day, they were largely used for livestock feed. Emmer was also commonly called spelts, according to Prescott's Weekly Journal Miner. But in 1912, the Holbrook News disagreed and published a story titled New Grains of Hardy Merit. It began, spelts and emmer are really two distinct grains and differ practically as much as the pear and the apple. Emmer is the German name. Spelts is a plant of similar appearance, but quite different. In 1918, the Sossaman family homesteaded in Queen Creek and started growing grains and still do today. They've partnered with Hayden Flour Mill's new owner, Jeff Zimmerman, who mills their heritage grains into flours. They revived the name from the original Hayden family, who had the landmark mill in Tempe for over 100 years. When Zimmerman started the flour mill, he discovered a list of brands that were familiar to generations of Arizonans, including Arizona Rose, which can be seen on their packaging. Try making this pioneer recipe with Hayden Flour Mill's heritage flour. Tea rolls. Ingredients. 5 cups all-purpose flour. 1 and 1/8 cups warm milk, 100 to 110 degrees. 1 package quick rise yeast, about 2 1/4 teaspoons. 1/4 cup butter, melted and cooled to room temperature. 1 teaspoon salt, 1 large egg. 3 tablespoons 1% low-fat milk. Combine 2 cups flour, warm milk, and yeast in a large bowl. Cover with plastic wrap and let stand 1.5 hours. Add 3 cups flour, butter, salt, and egg. Stir for about 3 minutes or until well blended. Place dough onto a lightly floured surface and knead for about 8 to 10 minutes until smooth and elastic. If the dough sticks to your hands, add a tablespoon of flour at a time until it feels tacky, but no longer sticks. Place the dough in a large bowl coated with butter or cooking spray. Turn to coat the top. Cover and let rise in a warm place, 85 degrees, for about 1.5 hours or until doubled in size. Turn dough out onto a lightly floured surface and dust with enough flour so it's not sticky. Pat into 8 by 10 inch rectangle and divide dough into 18 balls. Lightly grease a 13 by 9 inch baking pan and add the rolls. Lightly coat the rolls with cooking spray and cover with plastic wrap. Let rise in a warm place, 85 degrees, for about 1.5 hours or until double in size. Bake at 375 degrees for about 20 minutes or until browned. Cool rolls in pan 5 minutes. Serve warm or cool on a wire rack. Recipe adapted from Holbrook's The Argus, May 7th, 1896. True West, October 2022 edition. Like Father, Like Son. Inside History by Mark Boardman. Gunman gambler Phil Coe followed in his dad's footsteps, even unto death. Phil Coe was a dangerous man, a gambler and saloon owner who was responsible for several deaths before he was shot down by Wild Bill Hickok on October 5, 1871. He came by his nature honestly, violently. Coe's father, Philip Sr., started off in Georgia under an entirely different last name, Haddox. But he left that name and state behind in 1829 when he was accused of murder. A $750 reward was put on his head, so Phil Sr. headed west under his new last name. Coe was his mother's maiden name. He became a colonist for impresario Stephen F. Austin and received nearly 4,500 acres in Washington County, Texas. Esteemed writer Joseph Rosa says he didn't change his ways, living a lively and loose existence. In 1835, he joined in a campaign against the Tawakoni Indians. The next year, the elder Coe joined up with the Texians in their fight for independence from Mexico. Some stories say he was a captain in charge of a baggage train at the climactic Battle of San Jacinto. 3 years later, the family welcomed Phil Jr., the fourth of 12 children. Phil Sr. continued to serve Texas off and on through the mid-1840s. It's unclear just what he otherwise was doing during those years. He still owned the land where he settled in the early 1830s, so it's likely he was running a farm ranch. But it's clear that he liked spending time in saloons and gambling halls and racetracks. He owned several thoroughbreds. But life in the fast lane would ultimately lead to his demise. In December 1852, Coe was playing poker in a Gonzales County watering hole. One of the other players was a neighbor, John Oliver. At some point in the proceedings, the two men began arguing over one of the hands. Oliver pulled his gun and shot Coe. But the wounded man was tough. He managed to get to his horse and ride home. Over the next week, Coe laboriously wrote his will, splitting his estate, which included several slaves, between his wife and children. On December 14th, Phil Coe Sr. cashed in his chips. He was buried in the family cemetery. Phil Jr. was just 13 years old when his dad died, but it's apparent that the son didn't learn any life lessons from his father. 19 years after the old man's demise, the younger was one of the last men killed by Wild Bill Hickok. Phil Jr. was his own man in one respect. He was not buried in the same cemetery as his father. True West, October 2022 edition. Shooting Back. The Real History of a Handcart. As a former news photographer and longtime fan of railroading, may I offer some observations? The scene is of a track inspection being made soon after track had been laid. That the track is newly laid can be deduced by the paucity of ballast between the ties. Notice that the ties are of unequal length, sawed from round trunks, and flattened on two sides. The vehicle floor is of rough lumber and missing a board or two, showing signs of heavy use. It shows no means of propulsion, such as a two-handled lever to drive a crank that would be typical of what is called a speeder. It looks like the type of low cart that is used to receive rails offloaded from a flat car, then rolled to the advancing front as track is being set and spiked. On the cart, the men in caps are probably track-laying crew supervisors. The one in the forward position, more formally dressed in the hat and high collar, is likely their boss. The man standing is the photographer who made this photo. He is holding a tripod with the camera bellows with no limbs. His right hand is gripping something, perhaps a pneumatic bulb to release remotely the shutter of the camera making the picture. Seated at photo left is a man with his hands on a rod or pole to wedge against the wheel of the cart for braking or for pulling the car forward. The two track workers at the right of the photo just as well may be this day's mean of propulsion. The man in the dark shirt is holding a spike driving hammer. Follow the handle down to the ground and you'll see the head of a sledge or a maul. The man with his suspenders is holding a long bar to lift spiked rail and tie simultaneously for shifting into alignment. The two are accompanying the others to correct any loose spikes or crooked track found during the inspection. Thanks for the feature on the tourist railroads. I'm heading to Ely, Nevada. See you there. Russ Stolling, Fresno, California. Thank you. We love it when our readers provide all the historical details that can be gleaned from just one photograph. True West, October 2022 edition. Ask the Marshal. Pocket Guns, Ned Kelly, and the Kid, by Trimble Marshall. Question. I've read the transcript of Wyatt Earp's testimony at the inquest following the gunfight at near the OK Corral, and it seems he drew his gun from a coat pocket when the shooting started. Why would a professional lawman do that? Mike Burke, Wilmington, Delaware. None of the Earp brothers were wearing holsters that day. Had they been riding out to some ranch to make an arrest, they would have strapped on gun belts, but they could be cumbersome to wear in town. It wasn't uncommon for men to carry their pistols in their trousers or coat pockets, or even stick them in the waist of their trousers. Some men lined the pockets of their coats to keep their smoke wagons from getting hung up. Question. Are you familiar with Australian outlaw Ned Kelly? David DeRost, Lancaster, California. Ned Kelly is Australia's answer to America's Jesse James. Ned, the oldest son, got into crime at a young age, as did his brothers. He hooked up with a notorious bushranger named Henry Power, who became his mentor. As an adult, Kelly became a horse thief, train robber, and a murderer. But to some, then and now, he became a Robin Hood figure, fighting to help the downtrodden. The gunfight with police that he's best known for was in June 1880 at the Glenrorian Railway Station during an attempted train robbery. He wore homemade armor, but was wounded 28 times. He was hanged on November 11, 1880. Question. Is it true that the term cowboys was first used during the American Revolution? Andrew Reeve, Ramona, California. Most likely the term cowboys comes from the British Light Horse Battalion under the command of Colonel James Delancey. The name was given to them by American soldiers and farmers, as a battalion often rounded up cattle for the British in their raids. One might say they were America's first cattle rustlers. The term was no compliment. Question. Did the Indian tribes experience crimes such as theft, robbery, and murder committed by and against tribe members? If so, how was this handled? Rich Bauer, Wheaton, Illinois. Traditionally, there were many differences in the way justice was handled within the tribe. It usually depended on the seriousness of the crime. Some tribes, for example, allowed the victim's family to hand out the punishment. Others were decided by tribal consensus. Authority for decision-making was grounded in the wider social group, and approval to pursue any course of actions against offensive behavior was achieved through tribal consensus. Tribes throughout the United States have continued to rely on certain aspects of their traditional practices for administrating justice. Question. Should we really consider Billy the Kid an outlaw? Dale Pionk, Eveleth, Minnesota. Billy was a livestock thief, and ranchers considered livestock an asset, such as money. They were sometimes called hairy greenbacks. Also, he took part in the killings of four Lincoln County lawmen. I'd say that qualifies him as an outlaw. Question. Does any film, however short, exist of Wyatt Earp? Bill Haynes, Nashville, Tennessee. Wyatt never appeared on the silver screen. It was suggested he appeared in a group scene in the 1916 film The Half-Breed, starring Douglas Fairbanks, but Wyatt Earp scholar Jeff Morey slowed down the scene and determined the character wasn't Wyatt.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.